Today on Masters of Austrian Economics, we'll be looking at the contributions of F.A. Hayek, who wrote almost 20 books over 60 years. Of these, most of the ideas I'll be discussing come from his earliest works written in the 1930s and 40s. After this time, Hayek generally turned away from economic theory and concentrated more on political philosophy, to the extent that some have even talked of a Hayek 1 and a Hayek 2. Hayek 1 was very combative and took an active part in the cut and thrust of economic debate, especially against John Maynard Keynes. Hayek 2 was more withdrawn. After Hayek won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1974, feeling somewhat reinvigorated, Hayek 1 re-emerged, and he wrote a series of radical papers about currency and trade unions. Incidentally, if you were just to get one book by Hayek, I'd recommend Individualism and Economic Order, by far the best introduction to his thinking. If you want a one-stop shop introduction to his macroeconomic thought, Business Cycles Part 1 in the Collected Works series combines monetary theory and the trade cycle and prices and production. All of these are available for free at the Mises Institute, and I've linked them in the show notes. Hayek's contributions to economic theory are chiefly in his development of Austrian capital theory, as well as the theory of the business cycle, and then what was to become known as the knowledge problem. If you have not yet seen my videos on Bombaverk and Mises, it is strongly recommended that you watch them before continuing, because Hayek builds his ideas directly on top of theirs. In this video, when I talk about more capitalistic and more roundabout production processes, I am referring to the lengthening of the production chain described by Bombaverk. And when talking about the business cycle, I am referring to the Austrian business cycle, which is the intertemporal misallocation of resources caused by credit expansion as described by Mises. The rest of this video will not make sense to you until you understand these two things. In the 1930s, Hayek was dismayed by the sort of macroeconomics that was becoming en vogue in the profession, in both America and in Britain. In America, his targets were the now mostly forgotten duo of William Trufant Foster and Waddill Catchings, who wrote a book called The Road to Plenty, which Hayek would later lampoon in the title of The Road to Serfdom. In Britain, his target was Lord Keynes. Much of the capital theory in Hayek is an elaboration designed to refute the ideas of these economists. There were fierce debates at this time, and it was in this context that Hayek wanted to explain, in the clearest terms, the Austrian theory of capital, price formation, and how these things relate to the business cycle. In what follows, the original means of production means land and labor. Consumer goods means finished products bought by consumers, and producer goods means intermediate products bought by manufacturers. To help describe the Austrian theory of capital, Hayek devised this diagram, what is today known as a Hayekian triangle. I will mention quickly that if you read Hayek, you'll find that the triangle looks more like this. I have followed Roger Garrison in rotating it 90 degrees so that time runs from left to right. Let me explain what you were looking at. On the far left of the diagram, you have the original means of production, that is, the land and the labor. On the far right, you have the output of consumer goods, which are bought by all of the people in the economy. The distance from left to right is the time it takes to make the total amount of consumer goods. The numbers on the diagram do not refer to quantities, but to prices. Imagine them as referring to gold pieces, for example. The bars on the chart refer to various intermediate goods, which are used to produce consumer goods. Now, because this is quite abstract, I've tried to help you picture it by making the consumer good here bread, and all the intermediate goods, the ingredients you need to make the bread. But you have to remember that we are not just looking at one firm here. We are looking at all the firms in the economy. Or, for our purposes, we could just say all the firms in the bread industry. That means when you're looking at these numbers, you have to imagine thousands of producers of these various intermediate goods and millions of people as both the workers for these producers and as the consumers at the other end. Also, conceptually, you have to imagine that all of the workers are also all of the consumers. That is, the people you see on the left here are actually the same people as you see on the right. Think about yourself at work and then yourself at the supermarket. In one role, you're working for a producer, and in the other role, you are a consumer. All people in the economy with jobs are also at the same time consumers. So these numbers you are looking at is the total amount in gold spent on bread in the whole economy. The total amount of gold spent on eggs for the purposes of making bread by all the producers of bread. The total amount spent on milk for the purposes of making bread by all the producers of bread, and so on and so forth. Finally, you have to imagine that we are in an evenly rotating economy. That means that this 40 gold coins on consumer goods, the 32 that is spent on eggs, 24 on milk, is also spent in week 2 and in week 3 and in week 4 ad infinitum. Working at this level of abstraction, we are doing what is typically called macroeconomics. However, it was precisely with macroeconomics, as it was being done by the likes of Foster and Catchings and by Lord Keynes, that Hayek had a problem. Foster and Catchings had written a book called The Dilemma of Thrift, in which they argued that savings can be harmful to an economy because they can lead to underconsumption. In his treatise on money, Keynes agreed. This created a problem because in order to invest into capital goods, new machinery, new workers, new intermediate goods for the production process, savings are necessary. So the dilemma is created because if money is taken out of the total supply by producers for the purposes of investment, it means that there is less money to be spent on consumer goods. So what would be the point of investing as a producer if you're going to end up with less money and less sales because of the underconsumption that you have caused with your saving? And ultimately, they argued that in order to give an incentive for producers to invest more without producing this underconsumption effect, the government needs to step in and release more money into the total supply so there is no drop-off in consumption. It was this that Hayek objected to the most, and herein comes our diagram. Let us pretend that the money supply is fixed, that is, that there is no new money in this system. No central bank can print more. The producers decide to take 10 gold pieces from the general spending on consumption and to allocate it instead on stages of production. Let us say they've added a new yeast formula and some preservatives. Now, those 10 gold pieces are being spent in the production of intermediary goods and not on consumption. So on the face of it, Foster and Catchings and Lord Keynes are right. There is less money being spent on consumption. But Hayek points out that because the production process is now more capitalistic and more roundabout, the total amount of bread will increase, even though the total amount of money spent on bread has been reduced from 40 to 30. The per unit price of bread will naturally come down. For Foster and Catchings, and for Keynes, this is bad because they had this idea that deflation is bad. But Hayek argues that this is nonsense. The consumers now get more bread for less money. How can this be bad? All that has happened is that the relative quantities of bread and money have changed. The 10 gold, which consumers would have spent on bread, is now spent somewhere in the production chain to produce 20 extra units of bread. One may well ask, why would any of the producers do this? But remember that neither the total amount spent on bread as a whole, nor the per unit price of bread matters at all to the individual bread producing firm. Those firms care about their market share relative to all the other bread producers. So even in this fixed economy, the producer who invests in more capitalistic and roundabout processes before his competition may well end up taking a bigger piece of the market with his more efficient processes. It does not matter to him if the total pie is 40 gold coins or 30 gold coins. What matters is how many gold coins are spent with him relative to all the others. In this way, Hayek shows up the limitations of macroeconomic theory, which only uses aggregate statistics or average prices. These, he says, can tell you nothing about what is actually happening in the real economy, and it can lead to errors such as thinking that savings are harmful. And to show what he means, Hayek then takes his model and shows what would happen if the Keynesian plan of simply giving money to the producers would work. He shows what would happen. So now the government hand the producers 40 extra gold pieces to make their investments. What would happen here? Well, the per unit cost would still come down. But remember that money spent on the new producer goods must be reinvested week after week. In the case where the investment is made through genuine savings, the change to the structure of production is permanent because the money has been permanently taken out of the stock of consumer spending. So all other things remaining equal, we get this evenly rotating situation year after year. But in the case where the money was simply handed to the producers, they simply see an increase in their revenue. Since the change in the structure of production was induced by an artificial cash injection by the government, what happens when the producers simply blow their new takings on consumer goods? The total stock of consumer spending increases, but it can only increase at the expense of producer spending. Therefore, the structure of production will necessarily regress, becoming shorter and less capitalistic, less roundabout over time. What about the plan of Foster and Catchings, which is, instead of giving the money to the producers, as in Lord Keynes's plan, giving it directly to the consumers? Here, the producers have already saved and invested as per our original scenario, but the consumers are handed 15 extra gold coins. So, total spending is now 45. Hayek says this would frustrate the gains made from savings and would result in a reversion to a less capitalistic structure of production because the ratio of producer spending to consumer spending has not changed. And for these reasons, Hayek viewed monetary intervention by the government as being necessarily always a bad thing. Whether you give the money straight to the investors or to the consumers, it creates malinvestments, less capitalistic production processes, and exacerbates the severity of the business cycle. Where Mises focused on the effect of credit expansion, Hayek specifically looked at the role of government intervention and engaged in debate with contemporary economists on the left. So you can see how Hayek was expanding and building on Mises directly. In much the same way, Hayek developed what is known today as the knowledge problem in response to the chief socialist response to Mises' calculation problem. If you recall, Mises said that even with perfect knowledge of value scales, socialism would run into the problem of calculating exactly which technology to use because of the absence of prices. The Polish economist Oskar Lang basically conceded this point to Mises and then argued that central planners could essentially simulate the market internally using trial and error. And therefore, they could simulate pseudo-prices, which could be used in lieu of actual prices. Lang famously joked that a statue of Mises should be given a place of honor by the Socialist Central Planning Board for his valuable insights. Hayek's response was to say that what Lang suggests here is impossible because the statistics on which central planners would have to rely cannot possibly capture the local knowledge of particular times and places, because knowledge is always dispersed among the millions of people in any given economy. Let's go through an example. You're looking to open a new restaurant in town. The data tells you that based on the last 3 years of business, these four sites have the following footfall and average spend per person. So those of you with quick arithmetic will have worked out that site D will make the most money followed by B, followed by A, while C makes the least money. So we go for D, right? But I wonder if the calculus will change at all if we add in just a picture of each of these places. And how about just a shot of the surrounding area? And maybe a shot of the last person to go into the restaurant? And perhaps we can add in what nearby parking might be like and how far away the local market where the chef can access ingredients might be. This is the sort of thing that it might be tricky to know without local knowledge, that is, knowledge on the ground. They may well affect your decision. Now, sure, you might try to collect data on all of these things and gather more and more numbers to build a fuller picture. But the point is that those restaurants, as they exist right now, including the sorts of clientele they have and the types of meals they serve, are perfectly honed to their local markets in a way that could never come about by explicit design. They emerge from their particular local settings. Of course, in the real world, all of these local factors will be expressed in the relative costs of these different restaurants, which we could see in money prices. Perhaps restaurant A has to pay a premium for being in the middle of a pedestrian zone, and restaurant D faces increased costs for security and insurance for being in a higher crime area, where restaurant C keeps down its transport costs for being located very close to the market. And now we have these costs against each of these restaurants, it's easier for us to make a call. And this is one of Hayek's central insights. Prices convey information even if we know nothing else. We don't need to know anything else about restaurant D other than its daily cost to know that there is some reason for us to avoid taking over that site. To use another example, let's use our ever trusty baker. He has got one supplier of wheat that he absolutely swears by. He's never met this supplier in person. He doesn't even know where the farm is. He just likes the variety which he gets at the local market. It produces bread that people like and sells well. But let's say that miles away, the farm that supplies this wheat gets struck by some freak weather event, drastically reducing the stock. This will naturally affect the price of the wheat, and without knowing anything else, the baker can switch to another variety of wheat. Now, what if the reduction in supply of wheat is so big that it affects all the prices across the board? In such a scenario, the baker might switch to a substitute good like rye or barley. Perhaps the baker might even buy a bit of both to see which customers like the best, while wheat is too expensive for most. In this way, producers and consumers alike can use price signals to adjust their decisions in response to changing circumstances as if they had full knowledge of those circumstances. And in this way, millions of individuals with disparate and dispersed knowledge can coordinate their activities in the spontaneous order of the free market. Next time, Murray Rothbard. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Stetson F. Lionel, The Ambivalent Onion, Christopher Scholholm, The Crimson Satyr, Chris, Kieran Haywood, Mr. A.M. Swainson, Radical Liberation, The Binary Surfer, Tragic Vision, Bailey and Aurora, Toyotomi Ami, Holy Spatula, Alexander, Froggy, Splice, Buck Egypt Society, Michael Meir, J. Greenriver, Michael Tynan, Heronius Napalm V, Vincenzo Rapio, and Edward Darrow.